From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Okay, here we go, hour two of our little show. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. If you care to be on the show, question or a comment, 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. I'm honored to have Dr. Peter Bregan on. He's a good one. He is so in tune and really looked into the whole psychiatric use of drugs. He has his website is really well put together, Bregan.com. Harvard University, Cambridge, 1954 to 58. Co-authored professional books. A diplomat in the National Board of Medical Examiners, Massachusetts Mental Health Center, State University of New York Medical Center, Psychiatry, National Institute of Health, University of Maryland, he worked there, Washington School of Psychiatry, George Mason University, Johns Hopkins University, private practice in psychiatry, Ithaca, 2003 till today, still practicing. Private practice, Washington, D.C., Bethesda. He's founder and director of the Center for the Study of Empathetic Therapy. And let's go to, I just want to give you his website, a few of his books for introducing him. There he goes. My mouse is a little slow this morning. His latest book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, Medication Madness, is another book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. Well, that's probably enough to get us started. Dr. Bregan, good morning. Thanks so much for being here, sir.
Good morning, Patrick. Good morning. That was quite a list of stuff you gave there. I must say, though, I was never at the Mass General. I was at the Massachusetts Mental Health Center, but I was involved in a considerable attack on the Mass General for doing psychosurgery and lobotomy up there at that Harvard program. But I was at the psychiatric program, which was the Mass Mental Health Center.
Psychiatric program, yeah. So, boy, there's so much to talk about here. But I've always wanted to ask a psychiatrist this. It's been my experience over my 72 years on this planet, Dr. Bregan, and studying spiritual matters, that all of these things that we humans kind of get have a problem with, right? Whatever, fear, anxiety, worry about tomorrow, money and stuff like this. These are really, in my opinion, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, these are more spiritual issues than they are brain issues, aren't they?
Yes. Well, I don't think they're brain issues at all in the conventional sense that there are no biochemical imbalances in the brain, Patrick. That's actually a PR campaign that really began inside of Eli Lilly, the drug company that manufactured Prozac. And they were trying to figure out, how to really sell this blockbuster drug that was actually, as they knew, very bad for people. It was causing the volunteers so much anguish and agitation and anxiety in their initial studies that didn't even look like the drug could make it at all through the FDA. And so they decided to promote it as an absolutely harmless drug, as best as they could figure out. And they just pushed this. And one of the things they came up with that was incredibly clever was to push the idea that human beings have biochemical imbalances, that depression is caused by an imbalance of serotonin. And therefore, their drug, which disrupted serotonin in the poor rats and cats that it was being given to, even made the cats angry. They knew about violence before they even got out of the starting blocks, because their poor cats were getting hostile and angry in ways they'd never done before. So they just turned reality on its head And instead of saying depression grows out of life experiences, mm-hmm. life is difficult. We human beings have always struggled. We need to keep working on psychological and spiritual and ethical ways of living better. Mm-hmm. They said, no, no, it's your serotonin imbalance. But what they didn't tell us was that this drug actually, Prozac and every single other psychiatric drug, caused biochemical imbalances in the animals it was given to. There was no way to even know if it could correct a biochemical imbalance, because the only thing they could study was how it disrupted the imbalances.
So
just a big lie, a big lie.
So Eli was, so this whole idea of Prozac, is it, Dr. Bregan, one of the common SSRIs as they're known?
It was Prozac was the very first SSRI, and it caused so much harm to people that I was the medical expert, the scientist, for well over 100 cases early on of violence and suicide and other things being caused by Prozac. And the drug company, which really has no conscience, went ahead and fixed a trial. They literally fixed this trial. I write about it extensively in Talking Back to Prozac. I write about it in Medication Madness, which is probably the book that would be most interesting to folks. Medication Madness, write about this trial. And they fixed the trial to make it look like they won a trial when they had fixed it. And that sort of just gave them a free road from then on. That's the kind of folks we're dealing with in terms of psychiatric drugs. And if that seems impossible to you, that a drug company could get away with fixing a trial, read Medication Madness. The whole story's in there it's and right documented. There.
So with these SSRIs, Prozac being the first one, and I suspect that was early on. I was trying to find the year. Do you remember the year when that came out?
Late 1980s, 89.
Very, very popular, and people talked quite a bit about it, of course. So did they argue that the serotonin in people who were depressed, there wasn't enough, and the Prozac gave them more, or they had too much? What was the marketing of it?
Well, the marketing was that basically you had sluggish serotonin and it needed to be jacked up.
I see.
And what their drug did, and most of the antidepressants do, among many other things that they muck up in the brain, is it blocked the removal of serotonin from the synapse, from the active place in your brain where it does the work. It blocked the removal of it. So in effect, in terms of people who had older cars, it flooded your engine. It floods your engine.
Yeah.
And the brain didn't like this. They didn't write about this, that the brain fought back on the first dose to an animal where the animal's brain sensed that it was getting too much of the serotonin, but blocking the removal of serotonin from the brain. The brain shut down producing any serotonin for a while until it could catch up. And then the brain developed other methods of compensating, and you end up with this very unstable situation. You're in a crapshoot. Your random situation is what's going to happen to you, because the brain is struggling against this foreign alien intrusion. So it's just bizarre that they got away with this, still get away with this. Doctors are still telling patients, for almost any drug they want to push on them, from the psychiatric drug that is, that you've got a biochemical imbalance. And in fact, every psychiatric drug causes multiple unpredictable biochemical imbalances.
Wow. So that's fascinating. It's the SSRIs, and they're all like this, the Lexapro, Zoloft, Selextra, all of these Paxils, these are all the...
Yeah, and even the drugs that are stimulating or trying to stimulate serotonin, the brain's not letting them do it very well. Wellbutrin, Effexor is a major contributor to human unhappiness. The problem people have, Patrick, is that because the drugs so change the brain, if you stop them for even a day...
Yes.
You're in danger of having a serious withdrawal reaction. So people will struggle to come off the drugs, and they go into withdrawal, and they think to themselves, well, I'm so mentally ill, that I can't do 1 or 2 days without my drug, because the doctors aren't warning people frequently enough that they'll get withdrawal reactions. And there are many people on these drugs who think they're mentally ill when they're just having terrible times with withdrawal. And it's important to warn your audience that, yeah, I'm going to be really critical of psychiatric drugs today. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm a clinical psychopharmacologist. I've probably written more about this whole area with in peer-reviewed scientific articles and medical books than anybody in the world. So when you listen to me, don't just stop your drug, because psychiatric drugs change your brain. And if you just stop the drug, you're left with an exposed, changed brain. So it has to be done slowly to come off psychiatric drugs. And that's my newest medical book, is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And you can get that, and it'll help you with your doctor. Probably not your psychiatrist, who will just be mad at you, but your general practitioner or your nurse practitioner may be, yes, you know, willing to work with you and with a therapist, because you need support. You need family support if possible. You've been on these drugs for years. You really need to have a lot of support coming along.
It's really important and critical to get off, really have help, right? And to do it very carefully.
It is.
Very
it
carefully.
Is.
So do we conjecture, there's been people on here conjecture that many of the problems that we're seeing in the shootings and all that are the kids that just kind of dump off of them. I think it was argued that Cynthia Yates, the lady that drowned her kids, that many of her, this is all hearsay. I don't think they've ever looked at the records because of the laws that she got off of these drugs. And could it be that a lot of these school shootings are tied in with the kids that are just getting off of them?
Well, first of all, I can give you a lot more than hearsay, because I've been a medical expert in some of the most horrendous shootings. So I can give you some real facts. And the Yates case, I was not a medical expert in, but my knowledge that I have from other folks is that she was taking antidepressants at the time.
Yeah.
And but let's go to some of the cases I've been involved in directly. And I was associated with cases relating to Columbine, going way back to Eric Harris and Columbine. And the newspapers, like USA Today, have come out and said, well, we now know that Eric Harris wasn't taking his Luvox, which is, again, an SSRI, a fluvoxamine, that he was not taking it at the time of the shooting. Well, that would be amazing, because his autopsy showed a, quote, effective level or therapeutic level of the drug in his bloodstream, which meant he took it probably the morning of the shootings, maybe the night before. So I have the autopsy report, the toxicology report that's a part of the autopsy report from the coroner's office, and I also have the report that the federal government required from Solvay, which was the company that was primarily involved with the drug, and it confirms that Eric Harris had a significant level of the drug. And his medical records show that he really started getting crazy after he started on the drug. He was started on the medication for having obsessive thoughts, and he eventually ends up in a psychotic manic state, which is something that can be produced by these drugs. So there's a case where we've been misinformed continually, and I can tell you with certainty that he was taking the medications. Then the shooter at Aurora in Colorado, he went to his psychiatrist at the university where he was, and he told her that he was feeling so violent inside that he was afraid to tell her because she might want to lock him up. But he wanted help, so he came for help. And what did she do? She put him on an SSRI antidepressant, Zoloft, for the first visit, and never took a definitive action to protect him or the public from his growing violence, which then grew and became one of these planned, you know, assaults on the movie theater, where he stood in front of the movie theater and just shot people down. Now, he had stopped the drug about a couple weeks before the shootings, but by then he was in a psychotic manic episode, and that's not necessarily going to go away In fact, it often does not go away when you stop the drug. It may even get worse during withdrawal. So certainly many, Patrick, many of these cases have involved either withdrawal or more commonly the direct effects of the drug.
So how do you even know that? I thought the HIPAA laws, Dr. Bragan, protect any of this information. Like, could one go in right now and say, we want to see what this fellow, I guess the latest one in Texas, what was it, last week? Or, I forget even.
Yeah.
What's the name of the city? Santa Fe? I don't know.
Santa Fe.
Santa Fe. Or the other one in Florida. Could you go in?
Parkland.
Parkland. Can you actually go in and say, we want to know what Joe or was on? And I thought the HIPAA laws protected that. Well, it was a private thing, and you couldn't get those.
Well, it's
records.
Not really the HIPAA laws. No, it's the state that protects that, keeps these things private because the state is under the heavy influence of the drug companies. I'll give you a great example of that, which is probably the most awful of the shootings, you know, that happened in Connecticut, where this young man went in and shot the practically the infants in the early school grades, shot them in the head, and a really good group brought a lawsuit demanding that the Connecticut Attorney General release this information, which he had the power to do. And in fact, I had gotten calls from people in the legislature of Connecticut asking if I'd been able to get the information because they couldn't get the Attorney General to release the information. And of course, I didn't have it. And we have a video of the hearing with the assistant attorney general in which he tells the people bringing the suit to get the information that they can't release it because if they release the information about his psychiatric drugs, people would stop taking them. So that's how much the establishment once in a while leaks out that that these drugs are so dangerous. They just don't want to let the information out. I mean, the drug companies are just multi-billion-dollar corporations with huge power, perhaps the most powerful lobbying groups in the country. Certainly when they join psychiatry and medicine, which they often do as a lobbying group, you're looking at the most powerful group. And it comes under the color of being good guys. So it's not like other lobbying groups say, oh, that's just self-interest. Oh, no, no. They come on as we need to help people. Dr. Bragan and other critics are going to stop people from getting help from the drugs. Yet most psychiatric drugs, in fact, I don't know a single psychiatric drug that has proven long-term help beyond a few weeks, literally none of them. And most of those studies of the few weeks are very, very manipulated by the drug companies. Uh-huh. Who actually form them and pay for them. So naturally, they can manipulate.
So I guess it's no surprise. I mean, I've been in the media 50 years now, and the pressure that advertisers can have. And so, again, this would be conjecture, but just looking big picture, one can see the amount of money being spent in mainstream television on all these drugs. I guess it's no wonder. I mean, I don't. Once again, this is speculation. Why the mainstream media?
It's beyond speculation, Patrick. For example, when I was much less known way back in the 70s, I got on 80s. I got on major television all the time. I even got once on a major business channel after the president of Eli Lilly spoke and talked about the fraud that I had uncovered and written about in one of my early books. But then when the direct-to-consumer advertising developed and all the stations became deeply dependent on drug company advertising, then people like me lost most of our capacity to get on major TV. So if you go back, I was on 20, 20, 60 Minutes, Nightline, ABC News, NBC News, you know, all of the morning shows. And I wasn't anywhere near as well known as I am now. But now the well-knownness means that, you know, our advertisers are going to pull. So it's very, very clear what goes on in our culture. And it's not surprising. It's, you know, follow the money is older than I am as a concept. So I'm not sure what is going on. Patrick, and why we're deteriorating. We can switch to a hard line.
Well, now it's coming back. You know, all I had to do was talk. So what you're saying is that I want to just reiterate, I caught that you used to do a lot of stuff on big shows, all these big shows.
All the time.
And that ended, right? That ended.
Well, it slowed down hugely. That's right. And, I don't even want to bring up necessarily the shows that I've been on recently because I think it targets them. I still get on major television and major radio, but nothing like in the past before there was direct-to-consumer advertising. And this is true for any critic of anything to do with the pharmaceutical industry. It's not just psychiatry. And in fact, the pharmaceutical industries that would not want me on the air or want a critic on the air, because now there are a lot of people who have, read my books, gotten involved in this, and are writing their own books, and doing their own research. But these companies, remember, they're making all kinds of things. And they're also related to the companies that are the same companies that are making agricultural insecticides and stuff.
Yeah.
So these are very, very powerful corporations.
Very, very, very. Lots of money involved. I want to talk a bit about ADHD. And can you give us some idea of the amount of pharmaceutical drugs being given to, say, kids under 21 these days? And for what?
Well, we don't have really good numbers, but here's some of the kind of numbers we have. Very likely 20% of boys will be diagnosed ADHD, 2 out of 10, before they get through with their careers in high school.
Wow.
And will probably be given psychiatric drugs. But that's not even the whole story, because many children are being diagnosed depressed or something else that gives them an excuse, the docs, to give them antidepressants. And antidepressants have big black box warnings that they increase the suicide rate in children. It's actually double is what the FDA says, but it's way more than double, because the double is in drug company runs. 6-week studies, 4 to 6 week studies, maybe 8 weeks. So imagine what a horrible rate it really is in real life out there in the real world, real people. It's going to be many times double for children, the rate, the increase in suicidal behaviors. So
is there such a thing as attention deficit? I don't even know what that stands for, ADHD.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Is it really a disorder?
No, it's not at all a disorder. What it is a million different things that require more attention from teachers and parents, particularly teachers. The drug was marketed by developing checklists for teachers on behaviors that were not considered signs of mental illness, actually, but were disruptive in the class. Talking out of turn, I mean, that's a disease. Talking out of turn, not paying attention, daydreaming, being restless in your chair, not standing online, playing excessively in the schoolyard. I mean, the whole thing is actually stuff that teachers have difficulty handling in overcrowded classrooms and when they don't know how to, project to their students sufficient engagement to keep them occupied in the classroom. Now, what would make a child stand out in that regard? Let's say, why would 2 out of 10 or 3 out of 10 boys in particular fit into that category? Well, it could be that they're just absolutely wonderful kids who, like all of us, were never built through evolution to sit still in a classroom of 30 people. There's no known tribe, clan, or tiny village, which is the first, million or 2 years of our mammalian development, that took all of its kids and roped them in the middle of the village, or maybe on the outskirts of the village, didn't let them go and play in the woods or play with each other, and then gave them the most boring person in the clan to stand over them for the day. I mean, not to blame teachers. The situation is just out of control. The schools don't meet our kids' needs. And some of the best, brightest, most spunky kids just have a terrible time you know, sitting still and obeying all day long. So I think a lot of this is just our best kids. There are other reasons too, though, that you could be getting in trouble. When they found out that 90% of the people getting these drugs were boys, the drug company said, well, that's a whole market of girls that we're not getting. So they started pushing another part of so-called ADHD, which is daydreaming, because girls like to daydream in class. They're imaginative, or they're often poetic. So they made daydreaming in class a part of the, quote, disease of ADHD. And they still haven't managed to get as many girls on these drugs as boys, because it's the boys' behaviors that are more annoying to the teachers and more difficult. And then, of course, then parents now are so pushed to for their kids to get good grades. If their kids aren't studying, then now the parents get corralled into what I believe is a form of drug company and governmental child abuse, which is drugging their children. Now, many kids who can't conform in school may also be hungry. They may have an illness. They may be abused at home. But by and large, in my experience, in a suburban community at least, that the children that come to me, they're just great kids who don't naturally fit into the expectations that people are giving them, and they're not getting enough attention from their father. So I tell the dads that, with a little smile, that the kid really has dad attention deficit disorder, DADD. And I get fathers to actually spend a few hours every weekend as a start with their son individually. And then they find maybe their daughter too, and maybe all the kids, they need to find a way of having individual time with dad. They get it with mom one way or another. With dad, because especially if you're a boy, that's where you're going to model and learning to be respectful and thoughtful and disciplined and so on. Wow. It's not really hard to deal with this issue in a suburban community. If you're in an inner city or highly urbanized community, you're dealing with so much family dysfunction, poverty. It's a wonder the kids get to school, let alone sit there. So, but whatever it is, it's not about a disease in the child. It is absolutely 100% not about a disease in the child. It's about a multiple of different things that then end up with either the parents getting anxious about the kid's performance in school, or the teachers not being able to handle the kid in class. That's a final common path.
And what's the, Dr. Bregan, what's the drug of choice that they give these ADHD kids, these theoretically ADHD kids? Is there a lot of that going on, and what is the drug they give them, and what does it do to the brain?
Well, I just have in front of me, and literally by chance, an article that came out last year, and it says, methamphetamine-induced psychosis. Methamphetamine-induced psychosis. Who says all drug use is reversible? So this is a medical article arguing that methamphetamine causes psychosis and it's not necessarily reversible. Well, that must be irrelevant, Dr. Bregan. Why are you bringing it up? Well, because as the article mentions, methamphetamine is one of the stimulants that doctors can legally give to children.
Meth?
Methamphetamine.
Meth? They can give kids meth?
They can give kids meth. Now, most of them don't. I've been involved in some malpractice suits against doctors where they gave methamphetamine to children, but it's perfectly legitimate. And it makes sense because methamphetamine is just a stronger variation on amphetamine, which is the most commonly given drug to children. Adderall is long-acting amphetamine.
And what does that do to the brain, amphetamine? What's the theory behind that?
Well, you know, Prozac jacks up serotonin. Well, methamphetamine has profound effects on serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine. It's highly addictive. It's very bad for the brain. Long-term, some children develop actual a loss of brain tissue long-term. You could see it on all kinds of studies that have been done of brain function, the MRIs and the PET scans. It predisposes kids to addiction. We have controlled clinical trials comparing kids labeled ADHD who didn't get the drug with kids who did get the drug. They become more prone to use methamphetamine and cocaine when they grow up. No surprise, if you raise rats on amphetamine, the very drug we give to the kids, or Ritalin, which is methylphenidate, but which is pharmacologically almost indistinguishable from amphetamine. And you raise rats on it, they become addicted, and they end up preferring the drug to the non-drug when they grow up too. These drugs cause psychosis in a significant percentage of people, not the percentage that's in the drug label, but the real percentage gets up to about 10%. If you look at clinical studies of kids getting these drugs in clinics, we can keep track of their records, 10% will develop some symptoms of psychosis along the way. Many become apathetic. The way the drug works, and this is true in chimpanzees as well as kids, is that for several weeks before the brain accommodates, the drugs produce apathy, indifference, a lack of caring, and also obsessive compulsive disorder. So the kids will sit in class, they will be indifferent, more indifferent, they won't socialize as much, the boys are not going to tickle a girl next to them. The boys are not going to be prancing around. They're apathetic, they're indifferent, and they're OCD, so they'll copy down everything the teacher tells them. There are no long-term studies that show any benefit from this drug. What they show undoubtedly in all the long-term studies is it suppresses growth. And it not only suppresses height and weight, which is all my colleagues bother to mention, it's going to be suppressing a lot more, because the way it does it is not by reducing appetite, which it does. It actually bollocks up growth hormone. In fact, if a kid has normal growth hormone, he's not taking his ADHD medication. So we've got this horrendous array of bad events from the disruption of three of the major neurotransmitter systems in the brain and the body. The idea of doing this kind of vast social experiment is it's unconscionable, and it's bizarre, and it's based on manipulated 4 to 6 weeks trials where, yes, teachers will report less quote ADHD in class for a few weeks because the children are apathetic.
And
it's just a
and
disaster.
This is generally happening to some of the most of the not mo- but to the kids who are really maybe kind of real special and active and want to learn about life, and you know, the brighter ones maybe even.
Yes, I think that there are two groups of kids. I know there are two groups of kids that are especially vulnerable. One is the kids in poverty who are going to end up, you know, in the special classes or in the foster homes. they're very vulnerable to all the psychiatric drugs. They're particularly vulnerable to the antipsychotic drugs. We have studies in Florida and other places about this huge proportion of these kids ending up on antipsychotic drugs when they're not psychotic. And of course, they get all the other drugs, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, ADHD drugs. That's one group of people who gets it. They're easily coerced. Any economic class of child who ends up in a special class or a special program is likely to be a very high percentage of them on psychiatric drugs. Then finally, the really educated parents who stay up with what they think is the latest science and really are motivated for their kids to get straight A's. I've seen those parents, you know, put kids with B's on these drugs because they want to give them the best chance in the world. I mean, it's they're just being fooled.
Do they? Do we know? Do these kids get off of these things, or do they just spend most of their life on them? What do you know about that?
Well, we have these follow-up studies now from the 1970s, which show the kids get off the drugs, but a statistically significant percentage then end up on other psychiatric drugs.
Really?
They don't end up on the stimulants. They end up on the antipsychotic drugs, the antidepressant drugs. Because this is the way it goes. It's pretty well-known, Patrick, and I've been able to track this a long time ago. It's just common sense. When you put a kid on a stimulant, one of the things that happens is they get agitated and anxious, as well as apathetic, which is kind of a dreadful state to be in. you're apathetic, but you're still feeling inside agitated and anxious. So they end up on benzodiazepines to calm them down, or they end up on a mood stabilizer to calm them down. They commonly can't sleep at night, so they end up on sedatives at night. Sometimes, as I mentioned earlier, they get psychotic, so they can end up on antipsychotic drugs. And so by studies that we have, and I describe these studies, and you can find them you can find them in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. What happens is the kids end up becoming more obese adults who have more criminal history. They have more mental hospital history. They have more suicidal history. Not everybody, but a statistically significant group ends up in this kind of condition on multiple psychiatric drugs.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Breggin, MD, Harvard-trained psychiatrist, former consultant at National Mental Health. He's been called the conscious of psychiatry, many decades of efforts to reform the mental health field. He's taught at many universities, authored dozens of scientific peer review articles and studies. He recommends, if you want to try one of his books, he has a lot of them, but Medication Magnus Madness may be a good one. His website is very well done and very easy to click around. It is Breggin.com, Breggin.com. You also have a YouTube channel, which is really cool. You're doing a whole series, and it's, what's it called?
Simple Truths.
Yeah, that's great. Simple Truths of Psych.
And I get so many people now watch video.
I know they do. We're going to have to go to video on our show. We're getting close to going to video here. Yeah.
Well, call me back for the video.
Yeah, we'll do a video and see.
I want to get more videos.
Can see how cute we both are, Doc.
Yeah.
So I watch a lot of films, done DVDs. I'm an aspiring screenwriter, and it's amazing to see how Hollywood treats this stuff, isn't it? I mean, they have women taking these Prozacs and Paxil and Celexol on these different shows, these TV shows, and Zoloft, and they pass them around to each other, and it's almost like common. It's okay. It's just like, oh, that's what we do. We have a glass of wine and we have our Prozac or whatever. And what do these drugs do to? And I guess a lot of ladies in the world are taking these things. They go right and they. What do they tell the doc? They're depressed or they can't deal with life. And what do they do to them?
Well, first, it's a lot of women and of course men. It's estimated that 20% of mature women, 25, 30 on up, are on just antidepressants.
Really?
Which usually means they're also going to be on a benzo to let them sleep, because often these drugs are stimulating and agitating. And the way people get on them is it just depends not so much on the patient, but on the doctor. You have to realize that a lot of this is not about the patients, about the doctors, sometimes about the patients. I mean, you could be trying to come off cigarettes and get on one of these. You could be tired. Just tell your doctor you're tired and stressed and get on one of these. You could tell the doctor that you've just lost your mom and you're feeling sad and get on one of these. You could tell the doctor you're having trouble raising three children without your husband being around much, which I think is probably one of the hardest challenges in the entire world. To be a single parent mother with even one child, and you'll get on these drugs. Now, these drugs long-term really cause apathy. It's even the textbooks, the American Psychiatric Association textbook for a number of years, I think they may have taken it out. They usually take out the bad things, said that it produces, quote, an apathy syndrome, the antidepressants. By the way, Patrick, one of the things to know is that all psychoactive substances just aren't really good for us. And over time, the most common thing that happens after exposure to these things over the years, and I include marijuana in this, I'm sorry to offend some folks, but you need to know it, it's apathy is what evolves over the years. And then the beginning of cognitive deficits, which usually start with short-term memory loss and difficulties with attention.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very real phenomena that happens to people. You want to beware, because you will be the last person to realize that you've lost your sexual feelings. Your husband or your wife will tell you. So these drugs erode that sense of engagement in life, and people mistake that for an improvement because they remember their suffering and they re-experience the suffering when they try to come off because of the withdrawal. So they get confused and they think that they need the drugs and that they're better because they feel less. That's not a good place to be in. You want to have feelings. You want to be alive. It's a much better way to live. And many people get better after a careful withdrawal and a little bit of counseling and family therapy. They end up getting their lives back together.
Dorothy is in New York. She said, I'm enjoying the show. Could Dr. Bragan explain how some of these drugs could be possibly the cause of these boys going in and shooting up schools becoming so violent? Can he explain that?
Well, when Eli Lilly first developed Prozac, one of the groups they tested on was cats. Now, it turns out these poor cats, you know, they probably 5 or 10 years in the laboratory getting drugs tested on them. And they're very nice cats. You know, they get used to being petted. They're grateful for the attention they get when they're not in their cage, I guess. And the cats started growling and snarling and hissing.
My goodness.
On Prozac. And then, this is a scientific article, you can find this on my website. By the way, I've tried to make it really simple. I have three really important resource centers, free, dozens of scientific articles. One is called www.123antidepressants.
Okay.
www.123antipsychotics and www.123ECT. Really trying to get this stuff out into the world at the lowest zero cost. In this case, you can read my write-up, you can see all this material.
What was the last one, ECT?
Yeah, shock treatment, 123, www.123ECT.com.
So we have 123 antidepressants, depressants?
One, two, three antidepressants and 123 ECT.
Right.
Wow. And that'll get you right there, or you can go there through my website, Bragan.com.
And find them. Yeah.
And you'll find these. You'll be able to find the cat studies. Go Control F on 123 antidepressants and put in cat.
Is the same thing happening then? To answer this lady's question,
same thing
happening
to the kids. Now, and what are the mechanisms? Well, they seem to be a bunch of different things the drugs do. One is they just cause agitation, anxiety, and irritability. So much so, and you can find this on the website. I really don't giggle and hang up. It happens to fish.
Really?
This is so biologic that there are fish studies. And they got interested in it because Prozac and Paxil, some of these drugs in the water, in the drinking water from being flushed in toilets,
yes,
were causing sexual deformities and other things in some fish. And so they started looking at behavior, and they found that it was disrupting behavior, making lots of different things behaviorally being disrupted, and as they studied mating, and one of the things was increased aggressivity. So this is really deeply rooted biologically, whatever the cause. In people, what you see, some people get delusions and hallucinations. One man thought his wife was an alien, and then he decided he was an alien, and it was a battle of aliens. So she was against the world, he was trying to save the world. And he loosened her safety belt and drove his car into a stanchion. Hmm. And then he realized, my God, what have I done? What have I done? And he picked up his wife, and she survived, thank God, and was found carrying her to the emergency room down the middle of the road in a bizarre state of mind. You get a lot of these stories in Madness, my book. Medication Madness. And one of the reasons I mention that is you can get it so cheap on the internet. I mean, So it's a very good source of getting information.
Here's an email. The great thing about Dr. Peter Bregan's book, Medication Madness, is his accurate statement, quote, "There are no secondhand stories in this book. His information is all firsthand experience. I really enjoyed the book." Oh, firsthand. No hearsay there.
No, so actually in the book, and believe it or not, I had dozens of cases. Every single one of them, but one, I had the medical records. So it's really direct information. It's mostly it's from legal work where I had access to the records. And
say we go back to this Santa Fe, which is the most recent. It seemed to be happening every couple of weeks now in Texas. I think 10 dead or something. Could somebody like you or an investigative reporter or a politician or somebody go in and say, we want to know through an autopsy or through medical records what was going on with this kid's involving drugs? Is that possible? Could he do it today?
Well, the attorney general of the state of Texas could probably do it overnight. But no, you can't get in, and the drug companies and all the people they support in the federal government, the mental health establishment, psychiatry, will give you a stone wall, and you won't get the information. We got the information on Eric Harris because he was over 18, and the threatened lawsuits from the media caused the state to release the autopsy reports. So it's very hard to get them. But yes, the government can release them. The state can release them. Public health interests. It's legitimate for the state to make public health determinations and release life-saving information. And we have a plague. We have a plague of violence, with much of it involving psychiatric drugs. Interestingly enough, not even street drugs. Not even street drugs. So it's mostly psychiatric drugs. And
the comparison to the addictive qualities, say, of all these? We're talking about the SSRIs, which are the common and messes with the serotonin, and say, I don't know.
Heroin
or crack or what's the stuff they do in the nose? What's the white powder in the nose?
Well, that's cocaine.
Cocaine. Yeah.
What's the comparison?
Yeah, what's the comparison is people getting off those? Being addictive. The addictive quality, yeah. Or opium, stuff like that.
Well, there's two classes of addiction. The common one that people talk about, which is that there's a tendency to take more and more of them. Those are mainly the sedatives. So the benzodiazepines like Xanax and Valium and Ativan, they are highly addictive, and there's a tendency to develop tolerance and take more and more of them just to ease the suffering that the drugs themselves are now causing, because the drugs make your anxiety worse. We know that with certainty, and again, it's very documented. They make you more anxious because your brain's fighting back. Remember, your brain fights back, so you're going to get from the drug eventually the opposite of what you wanted. You're gonna get what you originally had even worse as the brain fights back against the drug effect. So the good news about benzos is that you at least can get detox for that.
Because they're sedatives and...
Because the government recognizes that they're addictive.
Okay.
But beyond that, the psychiatric drugs all cause serious withdrawal reactions, and it can be harder to get off of Prozac and Paxil and Celexa and so on. Well, Butrin, Effexor, can be harder to get off them than off most illegal drugs.
Really?
Because it really can be emotionally agonizing, physically painful, shocks in the brain, bizarre feelings in your body. So that's why I really try to help people develop a program to gradually come off those drugs. But they don't cause enough pleasure or relief of suffering for people to take more and more of them. So because people don't take more and more of them and commit crimes to get more and more of most psychiatric drugs, they don't want to call them addictive. Now, the stimulants are also plain out addictive. The drugs we're giving to the children are addictive, and they do promote addiction in later life after you stop them. And they can be very difficult to come off of. Again, I lay all this out as best I can in psychiatric drug withdrawal. Mm-hmm.
So things like heroin and opium and marijuana and cocaine, and they're working on a different idea or a different
cocaine
platform.
Is identical in its effects to amphetamine and to methylphenidate. So cocaine is identical in the neurotransmitters it affects. The main difference between cocaine and the Ritalin you give your kid is that cocaine is faster acting and more potent, but it's the same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah. And any pharmacological textbook that you look at will classify together methylphenidate, amphetamine, methamphetamine, and cocaine.
So you went to Harvard Medical School when?
No, I went to Case Western Reserve Medical School. First, I went to Harvard College, regular Harvard.
Oh.
Then I went to Case Western Reserve Medical School, which is a very good medical school. I actually was able to do research there, like for a PhD, published papers out of medical school. And then I went back to Harvard for a year. I found them to be incredibly arrogant. They were totally into drugs overnight. When I went and applied to Harvard,
really?
I knew that, well, I already knew the professors at Harvard because I'd run a volunteer program for a year as a Harvard undergrad, ran a volunteer program. So I got to know the professors at Harvard. They welcomed me back for my residency. But overnight, they had changed from a psychoanalytically family therapy-oriented program to a drug program. They did it overnight. It was political. More money, more power.
So they actually teach you similar to, they teach the MDs if you have high blood pressure to give this or whatever.
That's exactly right.
So they
teach you
then, that's what they teach you. There's this you give them that.
Yeah, but it takes even more lying than the medical stuff at times takes lying. But it takes a lot more lying because they aren't diseases. They're not treating diabetes. They claim to be, but like diabetes. I mean, how many poor people have been lied to about that? It's nothing like diabetes. It's not psychiatric problems are not diseases. They come from being human beings struggling in the world.
Can you please ask Dr. Bregan writes Joy on an email, what the role possibly could be of heavy metals, lack of nutrition, minerals, and all this role in the behavior problems? Or do you treat patients in this manner?
I deeply believe that nutrition is critical to good health. But I believe that the supplements and the metals and all this other stuff is largely a way for another group to make a living. I work very closely with a nutritionist, Pam Popper. In November, we co-sponsor a conference together in Ohio that people can come to. I will have it up in my website pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But you can go to Pam Popper's website. She and I work together. She comes out of the China study by Campbell, which demonstrated that people live longer and healthier if they have a plant-based diet without any dairy. So you start with two principles, plant-based, and then you just don't do dairy. Cow's milk is not good for human beings. It's not good for babies either, by the way. So you want to do a plant-based diet, low on meat and fish, and it should be as organic as possible. You want to be eating a lot more potatoes and rice and whatever else vegetables appeal to you. And it's not an expensive way to eat, actually. She's shown that people can eat this way on food stamps. It's not costly. Beware of costly alternatives to good food. And that improves your general health, which will improve your mental health. But we have no direct interventions, as far as I know, that improve mental health. That is not how the brain works.
So
you need is
all
good food.
We hear a lot of conjecture. There's heavy aluminum or mercury or stuff in the brain involved with Alzheimer's. We've had people on this show. You don't agree with that? Do you think that's possible?
I have not seen the evidence. I certainly think if you do have lead in your brain, it's going to be terrible for you.
Yeah.
Or mercury. I have not seen the evidence that that is a routine problem, other than if you literally have mercury or lead poisoning in your lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, wait and see. I got an open mind, but everything I've seen about all of these supplements and the detoxes does not have scientific basis as far as I can see.
Fair enough. What would you then, if you had to come up with some of the causes and cures for this Alzheimer's, which seems to be epidemic?
I'm afraid that I don't have a cure for Alzheimer's.
What do you think the cause is?
I don't know what the cause is, but I think exposure to so many psychiatric drugs is not good.
Yeah.
I'm sure that exposure to so many toxins that we have, and being a farmer or somebody and getting a real heavy exposure is not good for you. So we're going to find that toxins play a role. I'm sure they do play a role in ill health. And I think in that way, indirectly, they may also be affecting the brain. But don't get caught up on searching for something to fix your brain. That's not where the problem originates. Yes, exercise and a plant-based diet will change your life for the better. Plant-based, I've lost 35 pounds. I'm a lot healthier. I'm 82 years old. I don't even take blood pressure medicine anymore. I deeply believe in good health, good nutrition, but not in all of these costly and exotic interferences that people want to do. I don't know that they have any more basis than the psychiatric drugs. Most people, the problem, in addition to just general health, the main problems that bring people into states where they want to see a psychiatrist or a therapist have to do with conflicts in their lives, not having figured out the principles to live by. I've written a book called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. It's one of my most recent books. In fact, it is my most recent book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. I think that we come out of childhood inevitably with guilt, shame, and anxiety. We come out inevitably with some degree of numbing and anger. It is hard to be a child, hard to grow up. I describe why I think evolution developed these responses in us. And then if we have oppressive family lives or family lives with trauma in it or illnesses that cause us to be separated as children from our parents and so on, all kinds of things happen in childhood that make guilt, shame, and anxiety worse, make our anger and our numbing worse. And I believe that that's inevitable to some extent. And then we have to grow up and overcome these things through reason and love.
These are spiritual real issues, if you want to use it like that. And then working with the mind, which, you know, most people think they are the mind, and my conjecture is that we're not. We are soul. We are spiritual beings.
Oh, God, I'm so with you, Patrick. I tell my patients that it's impossible to feel love for God and love for other human beings and to be freaked out, upset, and want to die. That if you can keep alive your love of life around you, and if you will allow yourself to appreciate God's love, however you experience that, and the love of other people, that you will thrive. It's the getting there that's hard. And I endorse Christian therapists, and I endorse any Jewish therapist.
Regardless of the religion, God is God, right? God's God.
Yeah. Use God in your life. Use love in your life. But reason and love is my shorthand. I tell people it's impossible to walk down the street feeling grateful for life and hateful and anguished at the same time.
Yeah. Well, that's well said.
So it's very spiritual, Patrick.
Yeah, very is. Well, I'm really pleased that you get that. It's terrific. Not that it meant. Well, finally.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I want to do one thing before we go. So I'm hearing on the radio that yesterday I was driving in Austin and we have the Cornyn from Texas and he's talking about this Santa Fe thing. And I said, you know, now people are trying to say, well, this kid was bullied and that's why he shot these kids. And you know, the politicians will just skirt on the mental thing. But, you know, I've never heard anybody, have you, are there any politicians open to the idea that these drugs may be a real part of this thing, this whole problem?
Well, if you go to my website and go to my YouTube and you look up Sanjay Gupta,
yeah,
and you look up, I think he was governor of New Jersey or something, and then he was head of the, of our big defense thing that we have in this country. What is it called? I'm just blanking
doesn't
on it.
Matter.
But after 9/11. What is that guy's name?
Yeah, I know you mean. Yeah, National Security or Homeland Security?
Homeland Security.
Yeah.
I got quotes. I watched the TV because I go on the air a lot, and I watched the TV about this, and I had my assistant capture Sanjay Gupta and the other guy saying, well, drugs may be involved after the horrendous murders in Connecticut. So there it is. But it's never come up again. None of them have ever mentioned it again. But I got it preserved, and it's on the internet. It's on my website. No, they don't want to recognize. I'm sure they just got so much attack on them from powerful sources after they did that. You know, do you realize what you're doing? Blah blah blah. And I want to address the shame issue. Probably the most common factor in the lives of the school shooters is that they have felt bullied. Now, it's always hard to know if you've been or felt. I think that almost every one of these kids has experienced bullying. In fact, most kids experience bullying, but I think that there's a high proportion of serious bullying that these kids have experienced. Most of them are shy, so they're subject easily to humiliation. Humiliation is the most painful emotion in the world, and it makes us potentially violent. I talk about this and really explain this in my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And that is the most common denominator. Fuel that with psychiatric drugs, which disrupt self-control, make us aggravated and violent at times, and make us even psychotic at times. And that's your main combination. I think it's humiliation, and then in many of the cases, psychiatric drugs.
Yeah, wow. Well, it's an honor to talk to you, Mr. Bregan. Thanks for all your work. It's Bregan.
Hey, Dr. Bregan. I went to med school.
Oh, you went to med school, man! I tell you, I didn't know you had a stethoscope around.
You know why he said disturb? Because you like me. You can't believe the doctor.
I can't believe that's.
And I don't. I would never call you on that. But it's so critical because people want to know I'm a medical guy.
You are a real medical doctor and everything. Well, Dr. Bregan, thanks for your work.
I'm deeper, though, Patrick. Just not mister.
That's what, just like, I don't want to be a mister, man. Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Good work, and keep out there. And I'm going to write Senator Cornyn a note this morning, and I'm going to say, talk to this Dr. Bregan fellow and see if you might, you know, go somewhere with this thing. You know, he sounds like he's
you know who's covering this now?
Yeah.
Red State. Is covering this. Oh, my God.
What's Red State? What's Red State?
Red State's the biggest conservative website. And the head of the NRA, the new head of the NRA, Ollie North, brought up psychiatric drugs as one of the risks in school shootings.
Really?
And they put it up on Red State with direct access to two of my videos, followed by then access to four more, and then access to my whole thing. I should have mentioned that at the start. This just happened a few days ago. Go to my website, folks, and you can get for free my frequent alerts, and you'll go right to the stuff from Ollie North and from Red State.
Well, you know,
folks, this is a cross political line.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Believe me.
Yeah.
Don't get stuck. Political lines here.
Yeah, don't want to wrestle in the mud because you'll get muddy, boy. I tell you. Dr. Bregan, thanks a lot. Appreciate all your time. We had a great time talking to you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Right.
Peter Bregan, Bregan.com. I don't know anything about Red State, but, you know, well, pretty amazing what's going on, isn't it? My goodness. Yeah, you might want to write your congressperson and, I don't know, tell them to check out Dr. Bregan and, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe somewhere along the line we'll be able to get these kids help and get them off these drugs and they'll quit shooting people. Well, I love you. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. We're going to have fun tomorrow. I have lots to talk about tomorrow. Got a lot of questions on this mold thing. People are pretty excited about getting in the house demolded. We'll go through it all tomorrow. And, there's something really special with this Living Streams product. We are really pleased to add them with Daniel Vitalis and Shen Blossom and all the stuff we do. Check out the Living Streams ad on the top of the page. Click on there. And if you have questions about some of these products, I mean, my stomach, this burning thing has done so well in like 1 week. I'm just like, I don't believe in silver bullets. You know that. And and these are just probiotics with different herbs. So, this was a God thing that got turned on to Wayne Blakely for sure. You can't know how often I said to God, okay, whatever it'll take, I just want to figure this burning stuff out. I mean, you know, could I take care of myself, right? There's just no reason in the world. All this aloe, but there was something else going on, just some kind of an imbalance that I hadn't been able to figure out for years, over 2 years, you know, and all the people I have access to. So, you know, this whole idea of the microbiome and getting the right good guys and playing around in there, I mean, I can press my stomach right now as we're talking, and there were spots in there that hurt for 2 years that are not hurting as I do right now, and this is after 1 week. So he's got some real special things going on with these Living Streams. Email me if you'd like to get some insights. I'm learning more about these products. Once again, these are not silver bullets going to save the world. You got to do other things, but we're going to add these. Certainly, we've added these to our suite of products, and I think there's a lot here to learn and to try. And this whole mold thing, boy, I'm going to really try to do some more shows. By the way, if you'd like to learn more about mold, you could just go to our search engine on One Radio Network and just type in mold. Right there. Boom. Just type in mold. And you're going to see 3 or 4 shows that we did. Or it just pulls up the mold relief product. Oh, that's pretty cool. The show we did with Wayne Blakely, Dave Asprey. He did a whole movie, Moldy, first film about toxic mold. You might want to YouTube that one and watch that. Leanne Billings, co-author of Mold, The War Within. David Jepp talked about it. Richie Shoemaker. I'm going to see if he's still around and maybe get him back on. Sherry Rogers talked about it. We've talked about it. The Wayne Blakely Show is George Swanson. Man, we have a great search function. And George Swanson talks about how all the sheetrock made in China. So that's what we do. I mean, check this out. So we export all of this toxic building materials to China, and they sell it back to us as sheetrock that you get at the Home Depot and all the other spots. And all the pollution stuff goes into China, and then China doesn't even use it. They use magnesium oxide, MgO board, and you can go to breathingwalls.com, George Swanson's, and you can find out how to. Now they're beginning to make this magnesium oxide sheetrock that doesn't mold. Doesn't mold. And places in Europe, they don't even use our sheetrock. They don't even use this stuff. Places in China, they don't even use it because they know it molds. They use MgO board. I think the website is breathingwalls.com. That's it, breathingwalls.com. And you'll get some links there. And, maybe if you have a kind of a moldy basement with sheetrock, go ahead and tear it all out and replace it with MgO board that won't mold. So we're learning a lot of stuff. Stick around in One Radio Network. I guarantee you we may go down some black holes, and we will, but we're always looking for the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And very few websites do that, so that's why we love you.
From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, This is OneRadioNetwork.com.